We've got both counsel. This is the case of Crystal Dawn Weimer versus County of Fayette, number 19-1823. Ms. Jones, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Marie Miley Jones for then district attorney, now Court of Common Pleas Judge Nancy Vernon and Fayette County. I appreciate the opportunity to present the case even under less than typical circumstances. I hope all on the court, counsel, and their families are well these days. Your Honors, this appeal addresses the important defenses of prosecutorial immunity and qualified immunity, matters that this court is no doubt familiar with and addresses regularly, as demonstrated, frankly, by two opinions issued just yesterday covering each topic. I plan to address those substantive issues in this appeal, Your Honor, and unless requested or needed, not focus yet on the jurisdictional questions in order to efficiently utilize my time.
Since you're on top of our jurisprudence, Ms. Jones, may we start with the fourth issue, because it would seem that the Fogel opinion forecloses the argument about the dismissal of Weimer's municipal liability claim. Would you agree?
Judge Hardiman, I was going to indicate that given the court's decision, I would not be arguing that issue today.
Okay, very good. That makes things a little bit easier. All right, which of the other issues do you want to start with?
Thank you. I'll start with qualified immunity. This issue, this defense, as the court is familiar, protects government officials from being held liable when their conduct does not violate clearly established rights. And there's a two-pronged test that the courts use in assessing this defense, whether the facts make out a violation of a constitutional right, and then whether that right was clearly established at the time of the alleged misconduct. That second prong could be said another way, that any reasonable official would know the conduct was unlawful at the relevant time. And I think that prong is a good place to start, because you can take either prong in making this assessment relative to the two issues that we focus on. The first of those two is the bite mark evidence. And actually, when you look at the trial itself, the bite mark evidence was presented in trial. It was raised in this complaint in the context of trial. And so really, there is an argument that prosecutorial immunity would bar it, and part of that claim was, in fact, dismissed by the trial court here. But to the extent it's been raised by us on the qualified immunity analysis, I go to that point first. Our position is that the issue was not clearly established at the time that the use of this kind of evidence would violate any constitutional right. This type of bite mark.
Ms. Jones, let me just interrupt you before you get into the merits of that, because I'm wondering whether the county waived the issue, because I'm looking at Appendix 137. The brief in support of motion to dismiss says, given that this was plaintiff's third attempt to set forth viable causes of action, these claims should be dismissed with prejudice, and plaintiff should only be permitted to proceed on her malicious prosecution claim against Vernon for her alleged involvement in securing bite mark evidence and her supervisory liability claim against the county. That seems to be not just a forfeiture, but a waiver. That's an intentional relinquishment of that argument, is it not?
I don't see the issue, but
I'm sorry, Ms. Judge Jones, you're cutting in and out. I don't know if we have an issue with the connection. Could you try it again?
Sure. Judge, I indicated that I was looking for that particular site on page 137 of the appendix, which is not the same for me, but that issue was raised, in essence, on behalf of Judge Vernon, not the county. So maybe I misunderstood your question.
Doesn't that mean that Judge Vernon waived it then?
No, I don't think she waived it at all. If you look to the arguments on look at the issue where that raised, have that appendix 129, at page appendix 129, and at the original opinion, appendix page 78, it was challenged and was raised in terms of indicating in the briefs, in the arguments, that we felt that the bite mark evidence was in fact dismissed for the most part at the underlying case, but to the extent the notice of appeal addresses qualified immunity generally, and the order from which the appeal is raised indicates that the bite mark evidence is evidence that should be included in the more specific pleading of the next amended complaint, we believe that issue is clearly preserved. So taking that backwards, the order from which this appeal was raised indicated that the bite mark evidence is evidence that could be addressed or needed to be addressed by Weimer in her second amended complaint, and that when we raised the appeal, we included the issues of that order, including relative to bite mark evidence. So I believe based on page 129 of the appendix and page 78 of the appendix and the order from which the appeal was taken, that that issue has been preserved.
Okay.
So in looking at that evidence, there have been cases in this circuit even that have said that this type of evidence, this bite mark type evidence, is viable evidence. Weimer presents no case law relevant to the time period to show it was not viable when it was first presented. They're utilizing information from the criminal trial, where later in 2014 or 2015, the expert walked back the decisions based on bite mark evidence. And therefore, under that prong of saying whether at the relevant time the law was clearly established, we believe the record's clear that it was not clearly established back in the 03-04 timeframe, and that any reliance by the district attorney at that time in utilizing it at trial was appropriate. And to raise that issue now for her use of that evidence, we think violates the qualified immunity standards.
Okay. Ms. Jones, if you could, moving to the civil rights conspiracy claim. I'm interested in, first of all, under the civil rights conspiracy claim, in the September 2018 order, the claim against was dismissed without prejudice with leave to amend. And then in the April 2019 order, the Second Amendment complaint alleges investigatory activities by District Attorney Vernon to support the civil rights conspiracy claim. So you're challenging both the denial of prosecutorial or absolute immunity for some of that and challenging qualified immunity to the investigatory role. What's your argument? What's your argument as to those two points? Because I think those are two vital points here as to whether or not these claims are allowed to proceed, both the prosecutorial side and whether or not you raised a qualified immunity argument as to the investigatory activities.
Judge Fischer, the court permitted leave to amend the order of the 2018 ruling. And so, therefore, on those issues, that order was not yet final.
Right. So I agree with that.
Until the order on the second motion to dismiss is issued, the 2019 order, those determinations made more clearly, I will say, with right. more detail by the trial court, are now, in our view, appealable.
Okay, and so you have, but your appeals to them, your argument is that the conduct which was within her prosecutorial responsibility, such as approving the filing of a complaint, that
correct.
She's entitled to prosecutorial immunity.
Yes.
The second amended complaint, however, alleges various activities that may not be prosecutorial, but may be investigative. And I wonder whether or not there's any claim to immunity that's remaining as to them.
We believe there is, Your Honor, because the differences between the first amended complaint and the second amended complaint on all of these points that are relative to both defenses of immunity are very, very limited and in very few paragraphs. And so when you look to the ability to say that that first order was not final as to all of these points, and for all of those reasons, we're going to look at anything more added to the second amended complaint to assess those defenses. Our position is some of the arguments remain, i.e., bite mark evidence, failure to intervene, were not clearly established, and others, we can look at both pleadings and both decisions and say, for example, the prosecutorial immunity arguments, that the facts as pled in the second amended complaint are still not enough and don't change the character function argument of the claim and in relation to the claims such that the immunity still shouldn't be applicable. And I can get to those specifics on the prosecutorial immunity. I just had been in the qualified immunity category.
Your main complaint, though, about the court's opinion is that she lumped everything together and said everything's investigatory and everything should go forward. And you're saying, no, a lot of it's prosecutorial. Should we not send it back to the district court and say, please parse out all of these different pieces of conduct, and were they conducted by Vernon or others, and decide which is prosecutorial and which is not, and whether qualified immunity as to the investigative is permitted?
Judge Riddell, that certainly would have been an easier approach. And
especially in
I think,
especially in light of Fogel, which instructs quite a lot about prosecutorial versus investigative.
And it also instructs on the good use of Rule 12e, which is a good lesson learned for all of us on the counsel side. But I do think, however, Judge Riddell, that it still can be assessed. I'm not saying that I don't think our arguments fly. And that is because of the very limited differences between the two complaints. That first order by Judge Kelly, in many respects, granted the motions, but gave leave to amend to fix them. Fix is not the right word. to attempt to address where the differences on this investigative versus prosecutorial function could be found. But she did not. In every instance, at least, say, you know, there's never going to be an assessment that could work. So she really started in the favor of the immunity defense and then gave leave to say you can add more if you want.
I'm just confused as to what you're asking us to do.
I'm asking you to find that the qualified immunity defense on the failure to intervene and bite mark evidence applies, and therefore those claims are out for good forever, and that the prosecutorial immunity can, in fact, still apply based on the limited changes that were made to the second amended complaint. So we think those defenses are still viable to the specific claims for this court to be able to analyze it. I do not disagree that a more specific delineation of how each of those allegations were or were not deficient would have been useful.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for us to review a statement by the court that this is all investigatory. We don't know what she was looking at. We don't know what she was deciding. And as Judge Fischer points out, we at least know the filing of the criminal complaint is not an investigative, you know, that's prosecutorial. So we have questions as to what was she deciding.
Right. And I think, Your Honor, I don't disagree, but at least when you look at her initial order that was then made final by the second order, you know, she says, for example, on the point Judge Fischer was raising on the conspiracy claim, you know, it states a plausible claim, including as to the bite mark evidence. So she's raising, for example, an area where we think you can now come in and make a determination on the qualified immunity argument that even though she didn't delineate it on that point, it doesn't matter. And you pointed out another one, as did Judge Fischer. On the prosecutorial immunity for the approval of the complaint, it doesn't matter. Those can't fly either way. So,
all right, what about the failure to intervene claim?
Sure. I think that one's particularly clear and particularly direct because there is no Third Circuit law establishing that a district attorney could be liable for failing to intervene in a what might be characterized as a reckless investigation. Your court's decision in the Jeunesse case made clear there was no reckless investigation claims that could lie. This isn't a case where there's there's no knowing violation of law by the district attorney here. There's been repeated findings. Even the trial court admitted there's no applicable Third Circuit law that says this is a viable cause of action. And Ms. Weimer can't point out any either.
And she even said, she even quoted the Fogel opinion saying it's an extension after the fact.
Right, she did. And it was an 18 or 19 decision. And frankly, your court's decision in Fogel didn't even go to that point. So I still think that's a viable argument that there's no failure to intervene claim no matter what, you know, investigatory, non-investigatory allegations are in this.
Let me try to sum up where we are because we've got a lot of different issues flying around. It sounds like you concede that a remand is appropriate for a do-over, in essence, in light of the guidance in Fogel, but that you would like us to knock out a couple of the clearer claims, for example, the most sort of notable one is this failure to intervene claim. Is that your position?
Your Honor, I don't think I'd go so far as to say I concede that. But I would agree that you could knock out certain claims. I still think you can make the assessment, even under Fogel's decision and other issues on the qualified and prosecutorial immunity. But there's certainly some that are crystal clear where others, I think, have, strong arguments.
All right. But at the very least, there's agreement, I think, that the district court did not engage in the parsing of conduct required in order to separate out what are the prosecutorial actions or events and what were investigatory actions or events.
I certainly would agree to that. We're trying to present that, and hopefully, you know, with a few more moments, I can identify a few of those relative to the prosecutorial immunity argument.
Okay. All right. We'll hear you on rebuttal. Let's hear from Mr. Culleton.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Joe Culleton, and I have the pleasure of representing the appellee in this matter, Crystal Weimer. As you know, Crystal was wrongfully convicted for a murder that she did not commit and was imprisoned for more than 11 years before, with the assistance of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and others, she was finally exonerated and released. I agree that the Fogel decision, which issued yesterday, strongly informs and supports the arguments that Ms. Weimer has raised, the substantive arguments on this appeal. But before I turn to those, you know, I think that the appeal is properly dismissible because it's improper, it's untimely, and it's premature. I disagree with the characterization of the first motion to dismiss opinion as somehow being a continuation of the second motion to dismiss opinion. The first dismissal opinion made definitive findings and conclusions. I respectfully believe that the district court did parse out certain conduct. You know, for example, the bite mark evidence. She found in the first motion to dismiss opinion that the bite mark evidence was investigatory in nature and therefore not subject to absolute prosecutorial immunity. On the other hand, she found that Judge Vernon's statements made to the jury during closing, where she lied regarding jailhouse snitches and not asking for anything in return for their testimony, she parsed that out and said that is entitled to prosecutorial immunity. So I do think she made...
But the judge specifically said with respect to qualified immunity, and I'm looking at page 18 and 19 of her opinion, that she wants to wait. She says, before it can be determined whether she's entitled to qualified immunity on this issue. So she's not deciding, she's not conclusively deciding the issue, is she?
I agree with you on the issue of qualified immunity, Your Honor. And I think that is the reason why, I think that's really the only properly appealed issue before the panel. Yes, I think you lack jurisdiction. It's our position you lack jurisdiction as to the absolute prosecutorial immunity issues. The municipal claim's been taken care of, but I don't think that she timely appealed those issues because they were dealt with in the first motion to dismiss opinion, and they were not argued at all.
Right. Just hold on one second. Let me make sure I understand your argument because I heard you to argue we lack jurisdiction over the appeal. Now I hear you to be arguing we lack jurisdiction over parts of the appeal. Is that right?
That's right. There are certain aspects of the appeal.
And you said absolute immunity is the part that we lack jurisdiction over?
Yes. That's our position.
And did the district court address absolute immunity in its second opinion?
Not at all. That issue and those arguments regarding absolute prosecutorial immunity were raised only in the first motion to dismiss briefing. They weren't raised at all in the second. And absolute was not addressed at all in the second opinion, so it left.
Yes, but weren't some of the activities which were alleged in the Second Amendment complaint to be investigatory activities, really prosecutorial activities, such as approving the complaint to which D.A. Vernon was entitled to prosecutorial immunity and had been properly raised in both motions to dismiss?
Well, that allegation was not added in the Second Amended complaint. I agree with Ms. Jones that there were a finite amount of additional allegations in the Second Amended complaint, and they largely related to additional investigatory acts of Vernon that we learned about in a police report that was attached to one of the other defendants' motions to dismiss. So the approving of the criminal complaint was already addressed. It was already in the first amended complaint.
There were activities which you alleged in the second amended complaint that related to the prosecutorial activities that led to the filing of the complaint.
Well, to the extent that there were allegations like that that were added in the Second Amended complaint, that they were not argued in Ms. Jones's second motion to dismiss. There were no prosecutorial immunity arguments that were raised by the appellants after the Second Amended complaint was filed, and therefore there was no discussion by the district court of absolute prosecutorial immunity in her second opinion. And so what her findings were in the first opinion remain undisturbed, and they were rulings that she set forth more than 6 months before this notice of appeal was taken, which is why I think you lack jurisdiction over that issue.
Okay, I'm confused then as to maybe what maybe I'm not the only one confused. I'm confused then as to what it is you say we have before us.
The issue of qualified immunity.
Are you saying that we have jurisdiction over all of the qualified immunity questions, including whether or not the bite mark evidence, whether or not we have she's entitled to qualified immunity involving her involvement with the bite mark evidence?
I don't even think you have jurisdiction over that aspect of the qualified immunity because that was addressed, those allegations, bite mark allegations, were addressed during the briefing in the first motion to dismiss. And they were found. Judge Kelly parsed the bite mark allegations in the first motion to dismiss and found that they were investigatory in nature. So she had already ruled on that, and again, that was not timely appealed. But even if
Judge Kelly in that first order, the September order, said she's not entitled to qualified immunity on the bite mark question, right?
Prosecutorial immunity. She's not entitled to prosecutorial
okay.
immunity.
She held off her ruling on qualified immunity.
Okay, so then you have the second order.
Yes.
And you have more specificity in your second amended complaint as to the investigatory activities that you were alleging D.A. Vernon could be liable for, right?
That's correct.
And the court in that second order denied qualified immunity as to those activities, and one of those activities involved the bite mark.
Well, I think, as I read the court's second opinion, she's not denying qualified immunity as to certain allegations. What she's saying is, at the motion to dismiss stage, viewing the factual allegations in the light most favorable to Ms. Weimer, that you have pled enough regarding Vernon's involvement in the investigatory process that the court finds that this claim should be permitted to be developed during discovery, which is consistent with...
Isn't that what qualified immunity partially is about, that the right to be able to be immune from having to go through the civil litigation process if, in fact, the constitutional violation either didn't exist or, in fact, if it wasn't clearly established?
I think qualified immunity, that does have those concepts, but only under very specific conditions and restrictions. In the Fogel case, cites that, immunity defenses will often require the benefit of discovery. That's citing the Russell opinion, and that is what Judge Kelly is saying here, is in order for me to make a reasoned analysis of whether or not you're entitled to qualified immunity, I'm going to need the benefit of discovery, and I'm going to allow you to develop that issue in discovery, because what we need to determine is, were Vernon's actions reasonable in connection with the constitutional rights as she understood them at the time? And we're not going to be able to know that until we can develop that further in discovery. But at this stage, taking our factual allegations in the light most favorable to Ms. Weimer, we've established enough that she's done enough investigatory work in helping the police in this reckless investigation that we should be allowed to develop that record to address that issue of qualified immunity after discovery. And that's consistent with the Mitchell versus Forsyth opinion, where it says a district court's denial of a claim of qualified immunity is appealable on an interlocutory basis to the extent that it turns on an issue of law. And she did not decide here that qualified immunity does not apply as a matter of law. What she did was make a factual determination that our factual allegations plead sufficient investigatory acts that we are now entitled to the discovery that these immunity issues often require. At summary judgment, If she makes the decision that qualified immunity does not apply as a matter of law, then I think that issue is properly before this, could potentially properly before this court. But right now it's premature because she has not made a qualified immunity decision on a legal issue.
Is approving the criminal complaint investigatory?
I think based on Vogel, that action is not.
Right. But so there's a reversal on that discrete issue at the very least, right? Shouldn't we explain to the district court why approving a criminal complaint is prosecutorial and therefore immune?
Well, to the extent that the court is inclined, I don't know that the court held that the approving of the criminal complaint was not prosecutorial, but to the extent that the court is inclined to remand with instructions to further parse out the factual allegations, I would ask that the court Judge Kelly to apply, do the parsing consistent with the standards that were just dictated in Vogel, and that would also include reassessing the allegations regarding the jailhouse snitches, because I think in light of Vogel, Judge Vernon's actions in relation to those jailhouse snitches are investigatory in nature.
That all makes perfect sense to me, speaking just for myself. But shouldn't we at the least kick out the failure to intervene claim for reasons that were suggested, at least I would argue, by the questions from my colleagues about the absence of any sort of extant law controlling the behavior of Vernon on that issue?
Well, I think the failure to intervene claim is going to depend on the reasonableness of her actions in light of what Vernon knew at the time.
But you need clearly established law saying that she must intervene, and I don't see any. Can you point to any anywhere?
Well, I mean, just the constitutional protections that are afforded to Ms. Weimer, that she has the constitutional right to be free from a reckless investigation or to have her rights, trampled on by people that are soliciting false testimony, using patently unreliable evidence.
That's too general. We're talking specifically about intervening. And these rights have to be well-defined in order to have been clearly established.
Well, as the court pointed out,
Judge Kelly's own opinion says that it would be an extension of law.
I agree with that, and as I was just going to say, as the court pointed out, there was not a case law specific to that issue, but I agree with her that it is an extension of the new case law, and what's in that, more recent opinion is something that, Judge Vernon should be held accountable for, even back then. It's not,
How can you say that when it's not clearly established?
Well, it's not dictating any case law that a reasonable district attorney should have known, be it then or in 2001.
You're making a policy argument that many agree with, but it's the opposite of what the Supreme Court has told us to do. The Supreme Court time and again has reversed circuit courts for doing two things wrong. Number one, holding people potentially liable when there's no clearly established law, and secondly, defining the right at issue at too high a level of generality, saying things like due process, equal protection, et cetera. The high court is requiring a case on point, aren't they?
I think it's reasonable to extend the recent decision the way that Judge Kelly did. I respectfully would take that position. I understand Your Honor's question, but I cannot point to specific case law prior to this. As I said, Judge Kelly conceded in her opinion, and I can't disagree with that statement, but I think it is reasonable to extend it.
Okay.
Would you one question I have for you, if you could answer this, the Monell claim, the fourth claim.
That's the municipal liability?
Municipal liability claim, yes.
I think that was essentially withdrawn, wasn't it?
Municipal liability or supervisory liability claim. What remains?
I'm not sure I understand. I thought that earlier in the argument, Ms. Jones said that she was withdrawing the appeal relating to that claim, so I'm not sure what you're asking.
I'm just asking whether, notwithstanding Ms. Jones's concession, what remains on the supervisory liability claim? It's a claim against Fayette County and or a claim against D.A. Vernon?
It's a claim against Fayette County.
It would be viable, wouldn't it? Because they can't claim the derivative prosecutorial immunity, so it's a viable claim. The defendants have withdrawn the challenge. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I'm asking what remains, and I'm asking counsel what exactly that claim is. Is it against Fayette County or is it against D.A. Vernon?
It's against Fayette County relating to their policies and practices that were in place there's allegations in there regarding not just Ms. Weimer, but other persons who were wrongfully convicted and imprisoned based upon these, deficient policies and practices that allow their, their law enforcement officers and district attorneys to, behave in this manner. And say they should be held liable for their actions because, they're responsible for those officials' actions, and their policies and the procedures that they have in place encourage, frankly, inappropriate behavior.
You also have a specific, do you have a specific Monell claim against D.A. Vernon?
I don't think it's a Monell claim against Vernon.
Supervisory liability claim.
Oh, it's supervisory liability, yes. We do have assert allegations of supervisory liability because she was the district attorney. And as the district attorney, she was directly setting policies for the county office, the district attorney's office, and the factual allegations show that she was, to some degree, supervising, instructing, authorizing the actions not just of people within her office, but also the police investigation.
And it's to that claim that's what I understood Ms. Jones conceded, at least her appellate claim as to that. She can clarify that later.
Right. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Culleton. Why don't we hear from Ms. Jones, and would you start where Judge Fisher left off there with that issue? I understood your concession to be that we lack jurisdiction to consider it and that we wouldn't get into the merits of that, but I may be wrong on that.
I indicated that in light of Fogle, I felt the jurisdictional challenge on the county, municipal, or Monell claim was not worth the court's time for me to raise today. I do not believe it's a viable claim against D.A. Vernon for supervisory liability on the basis of the law in that area. Yes, it is not, because a DA can't be responsible as a policymaker for the handling of particularized cases. It can only be if there's a policy claim for the municipality. I still challenge the viability of that, but that's not one I think I could raise to you here, because my municipal liability claim to you was based on the immunity issue. Yes. So, right. So, Your Honor, Judge Fisher, I agree with you that that's not a viable claim. I do want to point to two points generally. One is on the jurisdictional challenge about absolute immunity. I disagree with counsel in saying that we did not preserve that, and I cite to a couple of pages in the record to make that clear. Appendix page 78 is the order on the first motion. It did grant the motion initially, giving leave to address investigatory conduct on multiple claims, the malicious prosecution and the civil rights conspiracy, to which we had raised immunity, prosecutorial immunity. In our brief in support of the motion to the second amended complaint, beginning at appendix page 122, we do again raise, perhaps using a multitude of words, but we raise that the additional acts that were supposed to be added to show factually these were investigatory actions versus prosecutorial is again preserved. And so that continuing issue that we set forth in our briefs and I pointed out earlier would still stand. That is, the first order gave leave to amend on those points. The second order decided them, and our notice of appeal raises both immunity issues, so we believe those are still in play. And on those points, there were really four. The court's already addressed the approval of the complaint point, and I just want to very briefly pinpoint a couple of others. I think in Fogel, what's, you know, helpful in that point, in that case, despite having been a party in it, represented a party on some of the issues, that in assessing the specific facts for purposes of whether they're investigatory versus prosecutorial and looking at the function served, it also decides that it's necessary to make a connection to the claim of the plaintiff. And so you look at the claim of the plaintiff and then the function for purposes of making the determination if immunity applies. And in most of these issues, there's, first of all, no affirmative acts by D.A. Vernon. And secondly, they don't relate to the claim of the plaintiff. Many of the acts relate to, for example, evidence that was presented to her about a different individual, a Mr. Stenger, who might have been a potential target. So I think it's important with Fogel's instruction of assessing the claim of the plaintiff and then the function to see if immunity applied, that the presence at the crime scene, I mean, that would be every DA, frankly, but, you know, there's no affirmative action pled, no specifics of what she did or didn't do there that would connect to something involving Ms. Weimer. The presence at a meeting with Mr. Stenger's lawyer, again, presence in a meeting, the presence at an interview where a prior statement had already been gathered by the police, where D.A. Vernon's not affirmatively doing something based on the limited additional facts pled. So I think the instruction in Fogel can be useful and allow this court to address all of those issues, not just what might be the clearest one, the approval of the complaint issue, to say that immunity, prosecutorial immunity, does still apply.
Ms. Jones, can I take you back to the issue we discussed before about the waiver of the bite mark evidence? I had cited Appendix 137, and you came back with 129, I think.
Yes, let me go to that. Yes.
It's the same document. If you look at 137, the language I cited, it's the concluding paragraph in the very same document. So, It's the last sentence of your concluding paragraph. The very last sentence begins with the word finally on page 20 of the document, and which is 136 of the record.
Your Honor, I do see that now. I saw the concluding page and didn't think that was the page, but now I see your sentence. Candidly, it seems inconsistent with my prior allegation, my prior pages. So I'm wondering if that was a misprint. But on 122 and on 133, we speak to some of these issues. I think it's on 133 as well.
But why shouldn't we? I mean, that's a pretty straightforward statement where you say that.
Which page do you look at?
I'm looking at 137 of the record, which is page 21 of this document, and the document is the...
You're looking at the conclusion.
It's the conclusion of the complaint, I guess, right?
And I think, Your Honor, yeah, if I read that, I think we meant it to be a negative, because if you go to the context of 129, we again, in the substance of the brief, reflect at the end of the first full paragraph that there is nothing more than conclusory language with respect to the bite mark evidence. And so as we go through it, I think our position...
You're right?
Yes.
All right, let me just pull that up.
So that was a misstatement?
As I read it now, and I'm embarrassed by that, but let me just go through here. Because our arguments continue through the appellate briefs to reflect that the sort of qualified immunity issue is clear, that, you know, the bite mark evidence...
I'm not saying you lose the qualified immunity issue entirely. I'm not suggesting you waive that. It just seemed like you waived it with respect to the bite mark evidence, because your argument in your concluding paragraph is that none of this should go forward except the bite mark evidence.
Right, which doesn't sound like the defense lawyer that I am, right? But
it's Abe Lincoln 101. Abe always said, you know, you concede 5 or 6 points, then you get a lot of credibility with the court. So then on point number 7, you win the case, right?
So, well, that's why I wasn't arguing the municipal liability thing today.
Where can you direct our attention on appendix 129 to the specific line that you're relying on? Because I'm not sure which one it is.
Yeah, in the first full paragraph on page 129, the final sentence reads that the plaintiff's second complaint engaged in wordsmithing to plead the agreement and understanding, and therefore the claim remains nothing more than conclusory, devoid of anything supporting the agreement. Now, that was more specific to the conspiracy claim, so I see the court's position on that, why it might be confusing. We also believe that, frankly, the
letter about it.
I'm sorry.
I was going to suggest maybe you send us a letter.
I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to make that clear, and if I realize the concession, I will obviously include that.
All right. That's a great idea, Judge Rendell-Head. Why don't you submit us a letter within 5 days, Ms. Jones, on this issue? And if you don't concede the point, then Mr. Culleton will give you 3 days to respond, okay?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Jones from Judge Fisher or Judge Rendell?
No, nothing.
No, thank you.
Any final, you want to sum up, Ms. Jones? Do you have anything that we didn't address?
Your Honor, I think, no, I appreciate that. And I think I did raise the specific points on prosecutorial immunity and qualified immunity. We just believe those critical immunity defenses for government officials are worthy of consideration on the merits at this stage.
Very good. Okay. All right, well, the only thing we know for sure is that you all have more work to do on this case, but we'll have to figure out exactly what that looks like. So we will do the best we can, as quickly as we can. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we are very grateful to you both for the excellent argument and brief, especially under these circumstances. So hopefully next time we'll see you both in person.
Yes.